It's not often you get to really sample a piece of living history, but that's really what this next segment is about. It's about the story of a violin that's been in a family for over 200 years old, made in Scotland in 1820. Pretty close to that time, it made a trip from Dundee all the way to Tasmania, arriving in November of that year, and its passage documented as it went along. It's been living inside with the family for those two centuries, and right now it's in the studio with me, with its owner, and also a player who I'll introduce very shortly. The violin belongs to the Wilson family. Dr. Jane Wilson joins me this afternoon. G'day.
Hi.
Isn't it wild? I'm wrapping my head around this.
Yeah, me too.
It's one thing, we expect violins, a lot of good violins, to be old, but it's the story that comes with this instrument, which is amazing. Were you a muso yourself?
I was a kind of gawky adolescent and played a bit, but my dad was the better player. He was a Hobart architect and he loved it. So, yeah. I continued and I do play it, but not as well as he did.
It was always a part of the family lore, I suppose. I
mean, totally.
People always refer to the family violin.
That's right. Well, the stonemason who came out, William Wilson, he was around in his 30s, came out in 1820, and we've got no images of him, so it's what he brought with him that tells us about him. Gee. That's what's interesting about it.
Why did he come out? He wanted to...
Well, I think it was the sort of filthy conditions in Dundee. The opportunities were limited, the flax mills, the educational opportunities were limited, and thousands of Scots went all over the world to New Zealand, Australia, America.
Making
was part
your
of
life.
A big migration.
Yeah, I come from Scottish emigres as well, the 1870s. They didn't bring a violin, though. Now, tell me about this instrument and how you actually unearthed information about it.
Oh, it's been a real kind of detective story, really. When I lived overseas for a long time doing HIV policy, and when I came back from that, I got really into family history. It finally became relevant.
Yeah.
Started learning from a wonderful guy, Charlie McCarthy, and at night playing, fiddling around with it, I looked inside and saw this maker's mark. I'd been really kind of curious to know where it might have come from, because we've had it for all this time. Mm. And there was this mark with JAS, Jazz Sandy Maker Aleth. And I sat there in the middle of like, oh, what does this mean? We sort of started researching and found out that James Sandy was called the Aleth genius. So his dad was the Republican in a place called Aleth. And so this guy lost the leg, use of one leg when he was 12, the other leg when he was 17. So he sat in a chair or a bed with a tray over himself and made musical instruments, hingeless snuff boxes, and he trained birds to come and sit on his chair. He, most unusual character.
A legless violin maker.
A legless genius violin.
From the beginning of the 19th century.
And he died in, when was it, 1818, and William left in 1820. So somewhere between, and when I looked up just now on an app, you can go between Monarchy in Dundee and Aleth in 37 minutes by car, or it's an 8-hour walk. So how did he get there? How did he come back?
Of course.
Many more questions remain.
So the violin predates his death, so it's earlier than 1818.
Absolutely, yeah.
By some years, perhaps.
Might even been his father, John, who was also a stonemason, who bought it.
Yeah, Beethoven's still alive. I mean, it's wild. Beethoven could have picked this thing up. a legless stonemason. Anyway, it ends up in the hands of your forebear.
Well, the other thing we found out, I found this guy called, David Rattray in Kirkcaldy in Fife, and he figured from what we know about the imprint, which was rag paper apparently, because the imprint is very clear, he thinks it's probably the original, and it was worth about £4.
Which was a fair amount of money in those days, a 4-quid violin?
It cost him £70 for William and his wife each to come out as passengers, and a servant girl's wage was about £4 a year. So he was quite well off.
Right. So if a servant had saved every penny, they could
buy this violin back then. That's right. So it told us a lot about him. And it's still telling us things about him as we discover.
Now, on the way out, because it was, what, 4 or 5 months, wasn't it, the trip?
Five months, yeah, a long time.
To come out. Somebody kept notes on the ship about this.
We discovered a little while ago there's a terrific guy called Thomas Scott, who was a surveyor who came out on the same same on the bark skeleton. And he had this little diary. It was around 6 by 7 millimetres. And he wrote in this diary every day with these extraordinary stories about sort of animals being born in the long deck. There were some piglets born, I think, about a goose that was apparently not very well and was allowed to wander around the deck and got very, very tame. And then a couple of times he talked about the sky turned very dark at night and the captain expected a gale and he gave orders to get everything very clear. The wind was very variable. We had a dancing and Mr. Wilson played the fiddle and some sung songs until near 10 o'clock. This kind of thing happened fairly...
Oh, my golly. This is in 1820.
Yeah, 1820. That was 1st of August.
And that fiddle mentioned there is the one that's in the studio with us this afternoon.
As far as we know, because it's always been in the family.
Mr. Wilson played the fiddle. Then it gets here. And does he play it for a long time? What was his story once he arrived here?
He became the superintendent of stonemasons, which was like the precursor to being the sort of colonial architect, if you like. But after a few years, so he was involved in the first Supreme Court building and then went off some years later and became a farmer.
Okay.
And the violin came down through the family
as well.
Then. And then his grandson, my dad, Hartley Wilson, was an architect and played it a lot.
But that's how you keep them fresh and alive.
That's right.
You keep an instrument alive by playing it. Our guest violinist, Ed Wiener, is nodding in agreement. Look, if we get anything precious in our household, it gets broken after. I've got two kids. It gets broken after about five or six minutes. But this violin has survived intact. It would appear.
I think it's got some new bits and pieces. Edwina might have some comments, and Philip Smith too had some worked on it a year or two ago. I'm sure it's been banged about a bit, but it's still pretty much intact.
I better say good day to Edwina. How are you, Edwina?
Very well, thank you.
Violinist extraordinaire with the Tasmanian Symphony Orchestra. What's your usual violin like?
My regular violin was made in 1770, and it's of English origin. So it's not dissimilar from the age of this violin
this
I'm holding today.
Yeah. 1770 is the same age as Beethoven. That's when he was born.
Mm.
Oh, really, the past is with us.
Mm-hmm.
It's right, though. The secret to keeping a violin in good shape is to keep playing it, isn't it?
It's true. I'm not sure about the exact physics or science of it, but it is true. The ones that sit in museums actually don't sound very good.
That's right. You know, the Stradivarius is in the glass cases. Mm-hmm. Terrible thing to do to a living, because it's still sort of a living thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
really?
We like to think so.
Yeah. All this time, Jane Wilson, with this violin... Were successive generations of your family encouraged to play it? Did you?
I think they were. My parents' generation certainly were very musical. You know, one played the piano, the other one played the violin. The dog would, you know. Musical evenings were very much what people did. Less so currently, which is why I'm trying to sort of keep it alive and hoping for a grandchild that will continue it on and be an architect.
No pressure if you're listening, whoever it is. That's the thing. I mean, the violins in those days were procured because there were no radios, there were no record players. You know, you had to make your own music, and someone in the house generally had to be able to knock out a couple of popular tunes, didn't they? Yeah. So what are your wishes for this violin now that 200 years later?
We've got an anniversary coming up in November. It was supposed to be last year, 200 years, so it was postponed because of COVID. So that people will feel a sense of real pride in having a forebear like that and, you know, be really interested in what the violin's revealed about William that we didn't know before, actually. Mm. And it will continue on, I think.
Oh, of course it will.
Yeah, every time we talk about it, there's someone else who says, oh, what about this? Or did you know about that diary or this sort of thing?
Now, you talk about Philip Smith, who's a Hobart-based luthier. He's sort of the go-to guy, isn't he?
He is,
a lot of people go to Philip because if you've got a busted violin, he'll fix it. He'll make it better. Have you had it appraised? I mean, what does people say about the quality of the instrument, of the sound?
Well, yeah, quite reasonable quality. I mean, it's not a you know, totally rare thing by any means, but it's got that. The James Sandy violins were apparently very gritty. I don't know whether Edwina would agree with that.
Gritty.
Yeah, it's got quite a deep sound.
Yeah, that was the general feeling I had, and what David was saying, this Kilcaldy expert.
We'll get Philip on in a minute, and he can tell us. What is it, mate? Do you know what sort of wood is used?
No, I don't actually.
Yeah.
That would be the next thing to try and find out more
about.
He
would know. And he would know because I think it's different woods that go into it. It's not the same sort of wood all the way through. And he'd also know if it was modified or not, but of course, clearly it hasn't been. It hasn't been touched. It hasn't been modified in 200 years.
He thought it had a new bridge, actually, or the, no, scroll, sorry.
Yeah,
new
scroll. Yeah, you new can scroll. See a seam up here, which is not uncommon for instruments this old, but it's been very tastefully done. You can't really tell the difference in the wood.
Oh, it's probably the luthier concern at the time. No, that predates Philip, perhaps. Listen, is it worthwhile? Let's let violin say something. We've heard
absolutely.
From owner and player. Now, this is just to brief the listener once again. This is an instrument made sometime in the early part of the 19th century that sailed out with my guest Jane Wilson's forebear in 1820, played en route. Isn't that great?
Absolutely.
On the high seas.
Love
for
to
all
think
those,
about that.
All those dancers on the ship's deck more than 200 years ago. And now Edwina George from the Tasmanian Symphony Orchestra has got, you got a few bars of a Scottish tune or something.
Yeah,
haven't you?
I'll pull something out.
Okay, here we go. Look, that's sort of the music they would have danced to a couple of hundred years ago as well.
And for quite long periods of time too. It wouldn't have been half hour or so. They would have kept going for quite a while.
Isn't that amazing? I thought that violin sounded quite fine, to be honest. Lovely resonance, do you think?
Yeah.
What do you reckon?
Yeah, for sure.
We should mention, Edwina, the whole business of being someone thrusting a violin at you and saying, play this, it's not as easy as that, is it?
No, they are all quite subtly different. So the position of the fingers on the fingerboard could be different. So thus your pitch could be a little shaky when you first pick it up. And I also noticed that the angle of this bridge is slightly different to mine. So I had to adjust my bowing.
So straight away there are adjustments you had to make in terms.
Small
There's also
ones.
The business of just the character, the personality of the instrument, Jane, you know, that players always say to me, I have to come to know this instrument in time. I have to sort of, we have to get to know each other. And it ends up sounding like a friendship as much as anything else. Do you feel that way in relation to the instrument you play a lot?
Absolutely, yeah. You really have to be as one, otherwise you're going to be fighting against the sound.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. It's amazing. It's that human element that no electronics. Well, that was absolutely beautiful, and I'm sure you could do just as well, Jane. How's your own playing? Pretty good.
Pretty average. Pretty beginner. But even trying, I feel as if I'm sort of, I don't know, it's weird. It's as if William is sort of speaking through his violin still. I mean, there it is, and there was the maker's mark, and no one had seen it before that I know of. So he's around.
Listen, Philip Smith, the luthier, is with us. And g'day, Philip, how are you? You there?
Hello,
Philip. It's Christopher Lawrence here. How are you doing?
Yes, hi. You're very good, thanks.
Yeah, Philip, you're in the workshop, aren't you?
I am, yes.
Yeah, what have I stopped you doing?
Oh, that's right. There's a few people who came in at once, like they always do for me.
That's right. When you've got your shingle outside the door, you have to take care of everything.
That's right.
Do you remember this violin now, this of Jane's? She's mentioned you in passing. Apparently you've helped restore it.
Right.
Does it ring any bells?
Off the top of my head.
Okay.
Not off the top of my head. No.
Now the maker again was
James Sandy.
James Sandy.
James Sandy. Yeah, I do know of James Sandy. Yeah. There's not a whole lot of information about him in the kind of violin making kind of terms.
Well,
but there is reference to him, and there is a Scottish school of violin makers.
Is there really?
Yes. Yeah. And there's a very famous. This Scottish maker called Matthew Hardy.
Right.
Referred to as the Scottish Stradivari.
There you go. Well, James Hardy was just simply referred to as a genius. Matthew Hardy may have had more he may have had more legs than James Hardy. What are the woods most commonly used in violins?
Spruce for the top and generally maple for the back sides and the neck. It's a very specifically types of wood.
Yeah, and the different woods, why is that? Is that because you just get a better sonic result or is it an aesthetic thing?
So the top is spruce, which is a soft wood, but it's very strong. So that, basically adds up to a kind of very resonant thing where the bridge and the strings are connected to, and the maple in the back is hardwood so that the sound bounces off that.
Yeah.
Is a very basic.
Yeah, but you've got to get the dimensions just right, don't you? Because it's the difference between a good sound and a bad sound, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a very, I mean, all the things, every aspect of instrument makes, adds to the how they work.
Yeah.
So I never really worked it out, but counted up all the separate parts of a violin, there's 78 separate pieces of wood.
Wow.
And there are things like the arching and the thicknessing of the top and the back, which have make more difference, but everything has a bearing on the
Would result. I have been incorrect in thinking that when it was first made, this violin would have had gut strings rather than steel strings?
Absolutely, yes, yeah, definitely.
Which is a different sound, a different tension, a different everything, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The tension can be make a huge difference to the way it works.
Yeah. People are saying, can Edwina play again? She's only worked it. Have you got another 3 bars of tune?
Yeah.
Edwina, she can do something.
Oh, terrific.
Have a listen to this.
Yeah, great.
Here we go. Oh, yeah. Isn't that great, Jane?
Fantastic. Love it.
I love it. I reckon the TSO should play more of that stuff, don't you?
Absolutely.
I think that'd be a great dance. Philip Smith Luthier, the magic ingredient is the varnish. I presume this violin is varnished, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that's a thing that lots of people believe, and it's a bit of a kind of...
Is it a canard?
Is it the lost secret kind of things? I mean, the Scottish instruments, they often have that kind of similar to an varnish. It's quite distinctive kind of thing. So I think... Lots of different regions and areas had their own recipes.
Yep.
I don't think it's the ultimate secret, but it is one of the many things that adds up to the
result. Have you got your own mix?
We all work on different things, and there's all manner of ways to varnish an instrument. And in oil varnishes, where most good things are made from.
Yeah. Yeah. How many violins would you make a year?
Look, it all depends. I mean, I do all sorts of things. So currently I'm working on two double basses. So that's
a big job.
It's a different thing to making. So I've made about 60 instruments in total.
Yeah.
And 20 of them are cellos. So, to work out how many a year is a little tricky.
I know. All right, Philip, thanks for that. I appreciate your expertise on that.
No problem. Thank
all you. The best. Cheers. That's Philip Smith, Luthier, and... bit of a Tasmanian treasure. Jane, I'm thinking that you've got to maybe, I don't know, put on a concert or something. Don't you reckon? Go down to Willie Smith's or something and have a Scottish dance night and show off this beautiful instrument. Edwina could perhaps even contribute or bring.
What
bring
a terrific idea.
Don't you think?
Yeah, why not?
You always think that an instrument like this, it's such a beautiful sort of bookend, isn't it, to play it on the ship on the way out and 200 years later it gets played.
We're actually going to do a reenactment using the Lady Nelson and a couple of other ships later in the year. So
what a great idea.
Yeah, so we might rope in a few musicians too.
All right. Now, I hope you've got a good case for that because you now have to export it off the premises. Have you got a nice case?
Well, reasonable.
Protect it. That's a violin of more than 200 years acquaintance with a single family in Tasmania. Jane Wilson brought it in. Thank you so much, Jane.
Great pleasure.